to pursue this important foreign policy goal. And of course, utilizing the U.S. military is always an option at the commander-in-chief's disposal, she said. At a congressional briefing Monday, Secretary of State Marco Rubio floated the idea of the U.S. buying Greenland. White House advisor Stephen Miller talked about Greenland during an appearance on CNN.
The United States should have Greenland as part of the United States. There's no need to even think or talk about this in the context that you're asking of a military operation. Nobody's going to fight the United States militarily over the future of Greenland.
In that CNN interview, Stephen Miller defended the U.S. attack on Venezuela.
We live in a world in which you can talk all you want about international niceties and everything else, but we live in a world, in the real world, Jake, that is governed by strength, that is governed by force, that is governed by power. These are the iron laws of the world.
Meanwhile, Danish Prime Minister Mette Frederiksen has warned if the U.S. attacks Greenland, it'll spell the end of NATO.
Firstly, I believe that the American president should be taken seriously when he says that he wants Greenland. But I also want to make it clear that if the United States chooses to attack another NATO country militarily, then everything stops. That is, including our NATO, and thus the security that has been provided since the end of the Second World War.
We're joined now by two guests. Pavel Devyatkin is a non-resident fellow at the Quincy Institute, senior associate at the Arctic Institute. His new piece for Responsible Statecraft is headlined, Is Greenland Next? Denmark Says Not So Fast. He's joining us from Moscow, Russia. And joining us from just south of the Arctic Circle in the Canadian city of Iqaluit is Ayu Peter. She's a Greenlandic Inuit activist and attorney, recently featured in the documentary Twice Colonized. We welcome you back to Democracy Now! Let's begin with Pavel Devyatkin. Pavel, can you talk about what is at stake right now and the response by Denmark and also, of course, most importantly, the people of Greenland?
Thank you for having me, Amy. Trump says we need Greenland for national security, but his threats actually harm our security and threaten to destroy international law and institutions. In trying to acquire Greenland, the U.S. is acting like a rogue state with a reckless foreign policy. There is absolutely no military threat to the U.S. from Greenland, and no threat of Greenland forming military alliances with Russia or China. So this is pure imperialism. Trump's claiming that Russian and Chinese ships are all along the coast of Greenland and that Denmark can't protect it. But this is false. He's mixing up different parts of the Arctic. Russia and China do send ships into the Arctic, but those ships are nowhere near Greenland. They're way out in the Barents and Bering Seas, thousands of miles away. And the U.S. already controls Greenland in terms of military security, thanks to a 1951 agreement with Denmark that gives the U.S. control of a military base in the far north of the island. When Trump talks about Greenland, he keeps lumping the whole island together with the Pituffik military base, insisting that the only way to keep the base safe is to own the land beneath it. What we're witnessing is a dangerous might makes right worldview. You played that clip of Stephen Miller saying nobody's going to fight the U.S. militarily over the future of Greenland. They're really betting on raw military power to seize territory from a sovereign nation. And that statement came after Stephen Miller's wife posted a picture of the American flag covering Greenland on Twitter. She captioned the photo with the word soon. The White House is currently discussing how to acquire Greenland and not exempting military force. Trump's push to seize Greenland is also related to the island's vast critical mineral deposits. Billionaires like Peter Thiel and Elon Musk are also behind the push to extract these minerals for tech and to set up a so-called a libertarian freedom city on the island. I think it's also important to not ignore the timing. The attack on Venezuela and the escalating threats against Greenland conveniently come at the time that new Epstein files reveal Trump was on Epstein's jet many more times than previously reported. Officials are saying that more than 2 million Epstein files are still unreleased. Meanwhile, Americans are struggling with inflation, housing affordability, and crumbling infrastructure. Most Americans are opposed to the new war in Venezuela and seizing Greenland. Most Americans think Trump hasn't focused enough on lowering the cost of goods and services, but instead he's manufacturing these foreign crises.
So, Pavel Divyatkin, I wanted to ask you about this issue of NATO. Here you have the European leaders trying to deal with the fact that the United States did a 180-degree turn on the war in Ukraine and left them holding the bag of what to try to how to deal with the situation in Ukraine. Will Trump's move to try to grab Greenland basically rupture for sure the relationship within NATO between the United States and the European Union?
Yeah, there are real risks to the Euro-Atlantic community. European leaders are facing an existential crisis, and many are actually failing the test. We've seen the Danish prime minister warn that if the U.S. attacks another NATO country, everything stops, including NATO, and so that the security that has been provided since the end of World War II is also in question. Some European commentators are showing backbone. I saw the ex-NATO general Michel Yakovlev said how if Trump moves on Greenland, Europe must be ready even to fight the U.S. and to expel America from key bases in Europe. We saw how seven European leaders issued a joint statement that Greenland belongs to its people, but other leaders are shamefully weak. UK ministers are basically saying nothing, according to their own former defense secretary. Some are trying to appease Trump rather than defend international law. The Prime Minister Keir Starmer refused to condemn the U.S. military actions in Venezuela, but he stated he stands with Denmark regarding Greenland.
Could you also talk briefly about how climate change is changing the geostrategic importance of Greenland in terms of shipping routes around the world?
Absolutely. Greenland is the canary in the coal mine. The Arctic as a whole is ground zero for the climate catastrophe. And Trump wants to militarize the Arctic and Greenland instead of leading climate cooperation. The Greenland ice sheet is melting several times faster than in the 90s. We're seeing dangerous feedback loops. As the ice melts, it's revealing a darker rock and ocean that absorbs more heat and accelerates global warming. If Greenland's ice sheet fully melts, sea levels could rise 24 feet. That would devastate New York City, wipe out Florida, displace millions. And the fresh meltwater is already slowing Atlantic Ocean currents that regulate global climate. If these currents collapse, Europe could face extreme cold while the tropics overheat. Indigenous Greenlanders are watching how their traditional way of life vanish as the ice disappears. Traditional hunting, food security, forced displacement, these are all in crisis in Greenland and across the Arctic as a whole. Instead of partnering with indigenous peoples on climate science and adaptation, Trump wants to basically colonize their homeland for mineral extraction. The melting of the Arctic is also opening up Arctic shipping lanes, as you noted. Rather than working through international cooperation, Trump wants to use military control over these emerging trade corridors to compete with Russia's northern sea route.
I want to bring in Ayu Peter, Greenlandic Inuit activist and attorney, featured in the PBS documentary Twice Colonized. The documentary is a production of various media. I wanted to ask you about the response in Greenland right now to President Trump threatening to militarily seize or buy Greenland.
Thank you for having me, Amy. Yes, Greenland is not up for sale. That's what Greenland is saying, and Greenland wants its independence. Greenland leaders, elected leaders, and the population would like to have a conversation with Donald Trump on what it is that he wants. Greenland has worked with the United States since the Second World War, and they're open to communication on what it is that Donald Trump wants from Greenland.
I wanted to go to a trailer for the documentary about you, Twice Colonized.
I want you to hear this. We will always be here. We are alive.
I live in Canadian Africa, but I went to school in Denmark when I was a child because I was colonized by them. That's my colonizer right there. You want to see my lawyer outfit? No other people in court has that. Only I have the sealskin because I fight for First Peoples' rights. We should be included in the discussions as nation states are. Not bringing joy to me.
We forgot our language, our culture, our connection. There was so much destruction.
It's gonna cause.
Because you're speaking Danish?
Yeah. I haven't been able to leave the trauma and learned behavior behind. I find myself in situations that are not good for me, but that's what I know. Our children are going hungry. Our hunters are so humiliated. You're born to this world to make a difference. Look at this. The empire is here. What would you like us to do? Do you want us to be sustainable and traditional, or do you want us to be part of the modern economy? Guess what? It is our choice.
Oh, hell.
You become angry?
No, I'm just relearning my Danish.
Yeah. Aju Peter is the feature in Twice Colonized. And I'm wondering, explain what twice colonized means. As a Greenlandic Inuit, you were sent to Denmark to go to school. It sounds very much like the reservation schools in the United States and in Canada, where actually so many Native people died. But as an Inuit, if you can inject an Inuit voice into this conversation, whether controlled by Denmark or militarily invaded by the United States.
Yes, that's true. I was sent off. To 300 years. And then afterwards, when I went back to Greenland, I moved to the Canadian Arctic. And the indigenous peoples of Canada were colonized by Canada, of course. And now we would like our own sovereignty. We have, you can talk to us. We are demanding that decisions and everything else that's happening should be made with us, that you can't just take over a people or indigenous people just because you think you are so superior. You actually have to have a conversation with the indigenous peoples of Greenland and the indigenous peoples of Canada.
And how has the relationship between Greenland and Denmark evolved over the years? What in particular still riles you about that relationship, or feels that it's insufficient?
I haven't lived in Greenland since 1981. I can only speak on what I hear through the television and the radio. They wanted to become, Greenlanders wanted to become an independent country. But then the Trump administration, and Trump is trying to take over Greenland, so that talk of independence has stalled for a bit now. And Greenland wants to work with NATO and the countries of NATO so that they can oppose the threats from Donald Trump. You can't turn around and start threatening other NATO nations, and that's not acceptable.
Aju Peter, I want to thank you for joining us from Iqaluit, Canada, interestingly, which the Trump administration has also threatened to make the 51st state. I also want to thank Pavel Devyatkin of the Quincy Institute and the Arctic Institute. Interesting, you're talking to us from Moscow, Russia. A final comment on how Russians are responding to what the U.S. did in Venezuela. as the U.S. is involved in supposedly trying to end Russia's invasion of Ukraine, the irony of this invading Venezuela and abducting the president.
Thanks, Amy. That's very important. Russia's UN representative has condemned the attack on Venezuela, calling it a violation of international law, an act of state terrorism. Some Russian bloggers and veterans have also condemned the raid as a violation of sovereignty, calling it naked imperialism that strips away any American pretense of supporting international law. But many are also impressed. They're saying it should be studied closely, some giving credit to U.S. operational planning and execution, saying we should be taking notes, not just complaining. The developments are important for Russia. Moscow has invested heavily in keeping Maduro in power, deploying missile defense systems to Venezuela, sending military advisors, and using Venezuelan ports for Russian naval vessels. In a matter of hours, that investment has evaporated. These actions against Venezuela are catastrophic for any potential U.S.-Russia negotiations over Ukraine. How can Russia negotiate with an America that just demonstrated it will use military force to seize territory and overthrow governments it doesn't like? The Americans, according to some Russian commentators, have just shown that agreements, sovereignty, international law, none of it matters when they decide they want something. So why should Russia believe any security guarantees the U.S. offers regarding Ukraine?
Are the Russian generals saying that they should have just abducted Zelensky and been done with it?
That's right. Some are discussing that, and they're pointing to what lessons can be taken from Venezuela for Ukraine. You know, this causes really large risks for other security issues, including arms control. The New START Treaty, the last bilateral agreement between the U.S. and Russia limiting nuclear arms, is about to expire in less than a month, potentially unleashing a new nuclear arms race that would be catastrophic and costly. With this flagrant situation in Venezuela, negotiations are definitely going to be very difficult between the U.S. and Russia.
Pavel Devyatkin, I want to thank you for being with us with the Quincy Institute and the Arctic Institute. Next up, 1 year ago today, the fires in California. We'll be joined by MSNBC's Jacob Soboroff, his new book, Firestorm. Stay with us. Previous guest, the Greenlandic Inuit, Ayu Peter. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. 1 year ago today, the historic Palisades Fire and Eaton Fire started in Los Angeles, California, burning a massive path of destruction through the region. More than 30 people died, over 100,000 displaced, some 16,000 buildings and homes were destroyed as the fires burned. Then MSNBC correspondent Jacob Soboroff was on the ground reporting about the neighborhood where he grew up. This is an excerpt from a report he filed after discovering the home he was born in had burned down.
This is the first time that I've seen the house that I grew up in, and I don't really know what to say. Mom, look at this.
Is that from Tara?
Yeah.
Your birth house?
Yep.
I'm so sad. Every one of you guys was born in that house.
I know. It makes me sad, too. This was a really, really special place for the Soboroff family. And I'm very sorry to see it go. And I'm very sorry for all of the residents of Pacific Palisades and everyone across the greater LA area that's going through this right now.
That's Jacob Soboroff reporting a year ago. As recovery from the fires continues, Jacob joins us now to discuss his new book, Firestorm, The Great Los Angeles Fires and America's New Age of Disaster. We also had him in to talk about his other book, Separated, Inside an American Tragedy. Jacob is a senior political and national reporter for MS Now, formerly MSNBC. Welcome to Democracy Now!
It's so good to see you, Amy. Thank
it's you. Great to see you. A year ago today, you were reporting somewhere, and you get a call from your brother.
Yeah, my brother says there's a huge fire in the Palisades. It was actually on a text thread to our whole family. We're evacuating right now. And he had lived not far from where I grew up for most of my life, up in the Santa Monica Mountains, until I was about 18 years old. They left. The home they lived in ultimately burned down. The childhood home that I lived in had burned down and was born into. You know, and I think as you cover these things in real time, how do you process watching your childhood memories carbonize in front of your eyeballs? The answer is you don't. You can't, especially while talking to a national television audience. And so I wanted to do this book. I wanted to do Firestorm to understand what it was. How do we get here? Is it going to happen again? And the answer is yes, definitely. This was the fire of the future. And I experienced it in real time.
And Jacob, you talk about the causes of the fire and the subsequent defunding of agencies like FEMA and NOAA and the key agencies that can alert the public about these disasters.
Yeah, the thing about this book is that you're going to read, you know, it's a minute by minute accounting of what really went on. It reads like a sci-fi thriller, but it's just the truth. It's what we're going to experience more and more. And part of that story is not just the personal nature of this and how devastating it was to everybody, but what has happened in the aftermath. And you're going to read from the halls of power in Washington, D.C., stories of government officials telling me both in their official capacity and outside the official channels, because they weren't authorized to speak about the devastation that this particular administration, Trump was president-elect at the time, and it didn't stop him from spreading misinformation and disinformation, but how they have decimated FEMA. Senior leaders have left. The National Weather Service, that predicted this event as a particularly dangerous situation, has lost meteorologists all around the country. NIOSH, National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health, has lost people that look out for the well-being of firefighters after things like this. NASA's Earth Science Program is on the chopping block, and I flew with FireSense, their mission to study the future of fire and to map it using imaging spectrometry from the sky to make it easier to fight fires on the ground. I was in the Pacific Northwest, all for this book, with the Forest Service, who could not actually bring on firefighters at the beginning of this administration because of the DOGE cuts and the hiring freezes that were taking place. And so when you look at the fire of the future, it's a confluence of many things. Obviously, the global climate emergency, which you will read about in detail in the book, but also our infrastructure falling apart. The Altadena fire was a steel lattice tower that was not even active and had been sitting dormant for years that became electrified. Changes in the way we live. Electric car batteries exploding, 1,000 of them all over Los Angeles, one emergency management official told me. And then finally, again, this issue of misinformation and disinformation during natural disasters, the kind of which Donald Trump was spreading, saying things like we could just turn on a tap and have water flow down from the Pacific Northwest. I laugh, but it's preposterous. It is ridiculous. And those are the kinds of things today in this new age of disaster in America that Americans are contending with, in addition to the climate emergency.
Jacob, you have a fascinating story about Katie Miller getting in touch with you to see about her in-law's home. Katie Miller, married to Stephen Miller, talking about his parents' home and your relationship with her since Separated and your reporting on immigrants.
I couldn't believe it, Amy. Katie Miller was the person, as the junior most press deputy to Kirstjen Nielsen in the Department of Homeland Security, that invited me into the facilities to see family separations for myself. She didn't like the book, I think it's fair to say, and my reporting about family separation, so we had lost touch. But as I stood there getting ready to deliver a special report for Lester Holt on NBC News, my phone rang and it was Katie Miller. And I said I couldn't speak, so I hung up. But before I could even call her back, she texted me and basically asked me to go check on Stephen Miller's parents' house in the Palisades. You can imagine my surprise. I said, am I really being asked to go to Stephen Miller's parents' house? Well, just like I did for my friends that I drove in high school and my brother and other people I knew in the Palisades, I went and checked. They had lost their home. And for a second, maybe foolishly, I thought, you know, this adversarial journalist-source relationship, the politics of the past could be put aside. But within minutes, maybe even before she had texted me, Donald Trump and Elon Musk, both her future boss at Doge, were spreading, pouring rhetorical fuel on the flames of the very real fire. And it was very clear to me very quickly that while I had gone and done this, and I don't deserve any credit, as what anybody would have done, her own bosses were making the recovery and the fire itself worse for people like her own in-laws.
If you can talk about what's happening
and
to people.
Talk about how Governor Gavin Newsom.
Go ahead, Juan.
We had the same question, Juan.
I'm sorry. Yeah, I'm sorry. Describe how Governor Newsom handled this fire as President Trump and Musk and the others attacked him online.
You know, a lot of people have been making a lot of his current social media strategy to punch back against Donald Trump in a way equally hard that Donald Trump punches at him. And you will read about the origin story of that strategy, actually, in Firestorm. There's an incredible scene where he is sitting in his makeshift command center in Los Angeles watching Elon Musk during a live stream prod, I think it's fair to say, local firefighters on the ground about conspiracy theories related to why there was no water in the hydrants. And there are legitimate questions to ask about, you know, infrastructure-related questions about why a 117-million-gallon reservoir in the Palisades was empty at the time of the fire. And Gavin Newsom and Karen Bass and the Democratic leaders, you know, are not absolved in any of this either. But Elon Musk is there pushing these firefighters that are essentially saying to him, look, we were flowing so much water. It's like turning on all the taps in your house at the same time. This is what I heard from lots of firefighters. How can you possibly expect water pressure to remain consistent when you have three times the size of Manhattan burning in Los Angeles right now? Well, Musk seemed flustered during that exchange, and Gavin Newsom was watching it live, and he said to his aides in some pretty salty and colorful language, which you can read about in the book, clip that right now. F these guys, we're going to go back on the attack immediately. And that's exactly what Gavin Newsom did. They put that clip on the internet, and he said that was the beginning of the way that he has started to deal with the misinformation and disinformation now. I spent a lot of time with him for this book, and I think you're going to be surprised by what that picture on the right-hand side of the screen is. Me and him in Altadena days after the fire with the National Guard troops, which, by the way, is still dealing with the ramifications of that. He's trying to get he just got the control of the guard back, and he expects Trump to take it again.
And the migrant workers who tried to clean up the fire being targeted by the Trump administration.
He said to me on that very day in that photo off camera after I interviewed him for Meet the Press, I'm really concerned about what Trump, the president-elect, is going to do with immigration and its impact on the recovery. We got more undocumented people in L.A. than any other city in the country. I think it's 10% of the population. They are the prime targets standing in Home Depot parking lots. Not the worst of the worst, but the people that are engaged in the rebuilding of Los Angeles are the ones being targeted by the ICE raids right now. We've seen people run and die getting hit by cars on freeways by these operations. You know what they're doing? They're trying to find work rebuilding homes in Altadena and the Palisades. That's who the Trump administration is targeting, as Gavin Newsom points out.
We just have 20 seconds. People losing their homes, their property, they already had their houses burned down.
Well, and here's the thing. 40% of the homes and the lots that are selling now are going to corporate investors, not locals. L.A. is the most unaffordable city in the country and the most unaffordable state in the union. This book will show you the fissures that lie beneath our society that are exposed when a firestorm like this happens.
Jacob Soboroff, senior political national reporter for MS Now, new book, Firestorm, The Great Los Angeles Fires and America's New Age of Disaster. On Monday, we'll speak with filmmaker Andy Timmerer about her film All the Walls Came Down, about losing her home. We'll also speak with the main protagonist, the community activist in Altadena, Heavenly Hughes. That does it for our show. The film has been shortlisted for an Oscar. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Thank you for listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby Mountain.
With Canada's health system under strain, going digital can help heal our healthcare. From virtual visits for everyday concerns to faster, more accurate accurate diagnostics powered by AI. Technology is transforming care. Digital Health Canada supports the people and innovations behind this change. Learn more at digitalhealthcanada.com and subscribe to our podcast.